From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, comedian Paula Poundstone talks about her recent dalliance into the podcasting world and how her comedy has evolved.
I don't personally go on stage thinking, well, you know, I'm going to change hearts and minds tonight. But certainly there's a long history of comedy being, you know, both deliberately and inadvertently used as such a tool.
Later, playwright Catherine Trishman talks about the process of getting a play from the page to the stage.
The real challenge of new plays is that you don't know what a play is really going to do on the page. You just have to get it up with actors and see how it really operates.
And how building running skills is part of overall character and confidence development in young girls.
These girls are learning how this physical activity makes them feel better. It evens out their emotions.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Paula Poundstone has been a familiar voice to public radio listeners for years, most notably as a regular panelist on the weekly NPR news quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But Poundstone has been an influential voice on the American comedy scene since her HBO specials of the 1980s.
More recently, Poundstone added podcaster to her long resume, hosting a series called Live from the Poundstone Institute. But she continues to tour and do stand-up, and that's what brings her to Milwaukee on Saturday night when she performs at the Pabst Theater. Ahead of her trip to Wisconsin, she talked with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about how she weighs being topical with current events fatigue in an era of never-ending news cycles.
I've oddly become sort of addicted to it. You know, when I get up and I check the news websites in the morning, you know, if he hasn't said anything stupid, I feel kind of empty. You know, I talk a little bit about politics on stage here and there. It really depends on the night. I mean, after the Forbes magazine story, you just couldn't not talk about the alleged stripper allegedly being asked to spank him with a copy of Forbes magazine with his family's picture on the cover. That was just, I couldn't leave that alone. I was a dog with a bone. But, I talk about politics sometimes, and then sometimes I don't. It depends how much I'm thinking about it in the moment. I talk about raising a house full of kids and animals, and my favorite part of the night is just plain talking to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And in this way, little biographies emerge, and I use that from which to set my sails. I don't do the same thing exactly in any show.
Right. You're known for, you know, your spontaneous interaction with the crowd. And last time you were in Milwaukee, I was actually quite impressed by the way you dealt with a heckler. But do you find that audience demeanors are constant in a live stand-up setting, no matter what is happening in the world around them? Or do you find that audiences have been, say, a little more testy lately?
Oh, I don't think they've been testy exactly. I guess it depends on the night. I find that, you know, people are oddly grateful, as if they didn't go out and buy a ticket and pay to see me. People will say stuff like, thank you for coming, like as if I'm doing somebody a particular favor, because I think they're just so hungry or, you know, for comic relief, you know, because it is a stressful time. I saw a great interview with a guy on the NewsHour the other night who, you know, wrote a book where he was sort of proving the thesis that things are better than they've been in the history of mankind. And I welcome his ideas, but it sure doesn't feel that way.
Right. And with such a long-standing and busy career in comedy, do you find that you're losing tolerance with any aspect of it, whether it's the material that your fellow comedian colleagues are covering or the way it's presented? It seems that even though we get news from comedy and vice versa, that comedy is becoming much more so a call to action, especially on produced platforms.
I think that's appropriate, actually. It's, you know, sometimes when I'm on stage and we're laughing about, you know, the current state of affairs, I think about that scene in Cabaret when Joel Grey, the MC, is on stage and they show the cabaret full of people laughing and then they sort of morph their faces in the next scene. And then they overlay, you know, the Nazis marching outside. And sometimes I worry that we're going to laugh our way, you know, into complacency that, you know, that leaves us in really, really a bad way. Other times, you know, certainly there is a long tradition of comedy, you know, being a way to point out something that people might not be thinking about or seeing. And so you know, I don't know. I mean, I figure most of the time I'm pretty much preaching to the choir. And I don't personally go on stage thinking, well, you know, I'm going to change hearts and minds tonight. But certainly there's a long history of comedy being, you know, both deliberately and inadvertently used as such a tool.
You mentioned laughing our way to complacency. What are some ways that you're trying to not go in that direction?
Well, I mean, I think at one time I felt, I think I handled the topic a little bit more gingerly for a while. And you know, the truth is I'm not a political analyst, but I am a person who, you know, watches the news and pays some amount of attention to things going on around me. And, you know, I like to remind people of how much we need one another. And by the way, need all of us. Recently, I've been talking about the popularity of the 23andMe and the Ancestry.com, which is, you know, this thing that it seems very popular. I see tons of ads for these things, and I hear a lot of people talking about it. And what's really ironic is that it's in the midst of a global anti-immigrant wave. It's sort of funny that people on one level want to know, you know, where their relatives came from. And on another level, they want to make sure no more of them come in. I would say that at the Irony Awards, it would at least get a nomination.
And on the note of research and people grasping other areas of interest, many people know you as a panelist for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR Live Quiz News Show. But you recently had a podcast called Live from the Poundstone Institute. And I wonder, does this stem because you want to know more about the studies that, you know, Pete Segal references for a question or in
that
a way?
Precisely where it came from.
Excellent. You know, have you wanted to be a researcher, or perhaps you can work as a policy forum writer in the future now that you have more background in this?
Oh, man. I want to be the person who helps the scientists find the right hidey hole to put their stuff in, you know, so that it's not eradicated during the Trump administration. I mean, that a while ago, there was a story about this, you know, scientists being concerned about government research being, you know, copy it and have you know hide it, basically, so that the government didn't do away with it, which is, I mean, that's scary. I also heard on the NewsHour the other night that there are some school systems where they won't allow climate change to be taught, which is just a crazy idea. That's a crazy idea. Like, every now and then we've slipped from, you know, from annoying into crazy. I want to prepare snacks for the scientists if they go out into the woods to dig holes to put their research.
Well, and through talking with researchers about anything from is the 5-second rule true to, you know, the bacterial state of the ocean in surfers and on their bodies, you know, do you find that researchers are inherently that they have a good sense of humor about their work and they're willing to speak on it? Or did you find that you had trouble finding people to come on the podcast?
Oh, no, we didn't have trouble finding people to come on the podcast. And generally speaking, by the way, they are kind of serious. but that just makes them fun. You know, it's fun to talk to them. I'm the comic. I don't need them to tell jokes necessarily. They were good sports. I don't think anybody went away, you know, feeling like their work was so, you know, precious that heaven forbid anybody, you know, make a joke about it. If that were the case, they wouldn't have agreed to be on. Everybody knew what they were getting into. But no, there were tons of great stories. We stopped making Live from the Poundstone Institute for internal reasons that have nothing to do with the material itself.
Well, and when you were doing that, it's in front of a live show, and there's a mix of researchers calling in, an audience survey, and then a special guest, and you give them a little quiz on their own. But did you find that there's a big difference for you comedic or otherwise, between hosting a podcast live in front of an audience compared to stand-up? Because you did need that structure with airing the podcast and kind of doing it for time, more or less.
Well, it's a different, it's definitely a different project altogether. It's a comedic, I'm me either way. In either setting, I'm stuck being me. We very deliberately came up with a format so that, you could, plug the next participants into it, so that it would be good for radio or podcast. And I felt good about what we ended up with. I would love to continue to make it, but actually in the interim, Adam Felber, my chief of research, and I are we're right now developing another podcast called Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone, and it is also it's a comedy advice show, but it's an information based. It's fun to have somebody come on and tell you real information, right, that the listener can go away with and go, oh, I didn't know that, or that's interesting. And also a playground for making jokes.
Yeah, do you find that developing these podcasts is a happy marriage of what you enjoy the most when you're not doing stand-up?
Oh, yeah. No, it's been great. I've really enjoyed it. Sometimes when you're working and, you have to go through, we have shows that we didn't tape for human consumption. We just had practice shows early on, and where you're trying one idea or trying another idea, and it's brutal, because the ones that don't work are not that much fun, and you sort of have to go through that process in order to figure out what you're doing. So I definitely went through that process before we even began taping for air the Live from the Poundstone Institute. I still have scars from it. But it was fun, and we had guests that were absolutely spectacular. We had terrific scientists, and then we had, just for no reason other than because we wanted to, we had celebrity guests. We had Pete Docter, who I wrote and directed Up and Inside Out, and we had, we think we started with Dick Cavett. We had Kevin Nealon and Dana Carvey and Tiffany Haddish and Trisha Yearwood. And Lily Tomlin, it was star-studded. My affable nature wasn't enough to satisfy everybody.
And, well, there is the challenge of figuring out what will work, what won't work, especially in the world of podcasts when there are hundreds available subscribe to.
One of the only things right now when we talk about the country being so divided, it's not entirely true, because we have so much in common, which is that we breathe oxygen and we have podcasts. One of the similarities between human beings in the world right now.
That's true. And, well, do you find, of course you've had your platform established for a long time in your career, but that you're kind of in competition with yourself to have a podcast. Many comedians are trying to get that Netflix special going, yet touring live as the old stand-up routine that is still the bread and butter of comedy when it comes to performing as a solo act. Do you think that learning through this podcast experience, you'll concentrate on one or the other, or that you'll approach it in a different way with your new one coming up?
No. No one is me and Adam really having a good time. We worked together on Live from the Poundstone Institute. He's also a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is how we became friends. And mostly what we learned was how much fun we had working together. And so to some degree, we were like, we'll just take a flyer and we'll go do this thing because it's fun. And we'll see. Nobody's entire career is riding on a podcast, I would hope.
Right.
Mostly it's just a creative endeavor that we're so far really, really enjoying. And hopefully that, translate to listeners that would enjoy it as well. But I don't know. I think there's room for all of it.
Well, with your podcast coming up, what's a guest or an area of topic of interest that is your number one ideal that you would love to get on there?
Well, we've done a few. They haven't aired, but we've done a few. We had, we had someone that's a therapist come on and talk about empowering girls. We had a mechanic come on and talk about how to know if a mechanic is ripping you off. He didn't say it, but the answer is, they're alive and breathing. That's how you know they're ripping you off. let's see, we had a, a professor of ecology come talk about how to maintain friendships. We had a really great sports psychologist come talk about how he's worked with athletes, but also how you apply that same stuff in your own life. And mostly, you know, again, they're sharing real information. We're asking real, sincere questions, but it's also lots of fun.
Well, I look forward to the upcoming podcast. And Paula, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Sure. It was nice talking with you. Thank you so much.
Comedian Paula Poundstone performs Saturday night at the Pabst Theater. Poundstone is also a regular panelist on NPR's weekly news quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And it is getting to talk to people like Paula Poundstone, bringing her to Lake Effect, which is one of the things that your contribution makes possible. We are in day three of our winter membership drive. I'm sitting here with Mitch Teich, and we are hoping to entice you to become one of the 12 new or renewing members that we need this hour. 414-227-3210.
And because you know Paula Poundstone from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you can safely call yourself a public radio nerd. And let me just tell you that today only, when you support us, this radio station, Lake Effect, all the programs you hear, between now and midnight, or minute before midnight, you'll be automatically entered into a drawing to win what we would like to call the Nerd Basket. It's one of five WUWM gift baskets that includes a WUWM Day sponsor message. But that's only when you make your contribution today to 414-227-3210 or WUWM.com.
It is so great to have voices like Paula Poundstone's on. I know it's one of the things she's one of the voices I love to listen to on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She's also a lot of fun to talk to. All of us here on Lake Effect have had a chance to interview her over the years, and I remember not being able to really stop laughing during the entire interview.
Well, and the great thing about it is it's one of the few places where you can hear an interview in people's, you know, not just regular voices, but regular sentences, complete thoughts. And it's, I think, one of the things that makes Lake Effect distinct among programs that you hear in Milwaukee. Call now with your support of programs like Lake Effect, like Fresh Air, which comes your way in a little while, like all the programs you listen to right here on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, 414-227-3210, WUWM.com.
And keep listening, because coming up after a break, we'll meet the playwright of the new production at the Milwaukee Rep, One House Over. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Immigration is talked about in lots of different ways in this country. Comedian Paula Poundstone, in fact, talked about it in our last segment. A new play opening this week at the Milwaukee Rep is also a meditation on what it means to be from someplace else.
One House Over is part of the new play series that artistic director Mark Clements established to commission new work every year. Clements and playwright Catherine Trishman sat down with me in Clements' office at the Rep a few weeks ago. Thanks so much for having me here.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Pleasure, yeah.
Without giving too much away, and I know things are still probably changing a little bit, but how would you describe One House Over?
One House Over is a comic drama about border crossings, about geographic border crossings, psychological ones, how we immigrate from one country to another, and also how we relate to and get along with our neighbors.
Yep, that's fair.
or not
get along. Yes, exactly. I noticed this play, it's current, but it isn't right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's at a different time in the country's history, but not that different.
Yes.
Did you set it there on purpose, or was that just because you had been working on it and that's where you had started it?
Yes, I purposefully set it in the near present. So it's set in 2010. In part, I think it's very hard to write our current moment because of the political fireworks that have been happening. And setting the play in 2010 during Obama's first term gave the play a very clear perspective. like set in Chicago in 2010, when progressives were filled with a lot of hope for the future and excitement. And because the play deals with some tricky themes about immigration, I think there's a great dramatic irony in setting the play in that period.
Well, yeah, and it works with, in some ways, very well with what's happening right now. Maybe not intentionally, but yeah. it seems to talk about what's happening right now.
That's right. It's always great to talk about now at a slant, right? Because things are changing so quickly in the news. Something that might be true today might not be true tomorrow, but we know what happened in 2010.
Or at least we think we remember.
Yeah, we think we know. We know we know as much as anyone can know of
exactly.
anything ever.
And hey, you know, it's all a construct, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So the reason I wanted to talk with both of you is I wanted to get your perspective on what it's like to present new work and then workshop it as it goes to a production. So first of all, how did you two connect and why over this play?
They did produce a play of mine called How the World Began a couple of years ago, and I came up for opening, and that was the first time I got to tour the theater and meet all the fantastic people who work here. So I've known them for a couple of years, but this is the first process where we have dug in deep together and really seen a play from page to stage.
Yeah,
and so was it because of that other production, Mark, that you wanted to work with her this way?
Yeah, well, we liked that play a lot, and then when we started the new play development program, we had some means to start commissioning people and writers that we'd enjoyed working with and that we thought had interesting voices around the country, of which Catherine was one, and we commissioned her to do a play, actually, which was about Summerfest coming of age at 50. And that's still a work in progress and something that we are still interested in presenting. But we were in the middle of that process of developing that play, and just by chance, Catherine sent us a copy of One House Over just to get some feedback on, because it was a play she'd had and then put away again and picked up again, and it was like, hey, what do you think of this? Can you get some feedback? And Brent read it first and then said, I think you should read this because you know, it feels really very now, and I'm wondering if this is a play that we should consider. So that's how in the strange world of new play development, they pop up in surprising places sometimes.
And so were you surprised that One House Over was the one that is being produced first?
Yes, I was absolutely surprised. Yeah, but thrilled.
So what is the process? I mean, you had worked on this, put it away, brought it back. So this wasn't literally starting from ground zero. What was the process like once the agreement was made that, yeah, we're going to produce this?
The first thing we did was just workshop the play on the page. So we hired a dramaturg named Abigail Gonda, who I'd worked with for a long time, who lives in London, actually. And she just gave me notes over the phone and in conjunction with the folks here at the Rep. And we just did some rewrites on the page. So that was the first step. And then the second step was we developed the play together with a group of actors actually up in Door County as part of the Connecticut Arts Festival. The real challenge of new plays is that you don't know what a play is really going to do on the page. You just have to get it up with actors and see how it really operates. And that's the true challenge of it. And what's been so great about this process is we've been able to do two developmental workshops with actors before we even went into rehearsal. And that makes a huge difference in terms of our understanding of the play, how it works, why it works. It was incredible.
And what parts don't work and how you can make it work.
Exactly.
So for you in that workshop, you're taking notes, you're getting ideas. Are you rewriting as the workshop is happening?
Yeah, always. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so Mark, you know, that's happening just literally around the table as people stand up with it?
Yeah. I mean, mostly around the table in a workshop, but then we usually end up with something sort of presentational, sometimes with just for us to hear it off the page. Each reading has its own different requirements, and sometimes we, you know, it could be a full backers and sponsors event. We're trying to open the new play development process to the public when appropriate and to our donors, just because I think it's interesting for them to see how we make our work, you know, page to stage. And everything is different. I mean, Catherine said something to me last night which I kind of was really happy to hear, which I think we've been actively trying to do, is like one size does not fit all for every writer. Every writer has a different need. They write at different paces. They have different process. They need, you know, some need much more time away. Some need to be in the room less, some more. You know, it's like children. You know, they're all your kids, but they need different things. And you have to learn and be responsive to that and try and go with the flow. And Catherine was saying, you know, that she'd felt very supported in this process of bringing the play to where it is now. And, you know, I was really happy because that's kind of what we've tried to do, you know, not to have a formula that we just stick to rigidly and be open where possible and where resources are available to support different people's processes. Because at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is bring the very best of work to fruition. And it starts with supporting the writer so they feel able to bring their best work to us.
Are you comfortable, Catherine, with direct feedback from actors saying, hey, you know, this line just doesn't work for me or doesn't seem to work with the character?
Sure, absolutely. The truth is, actors, I think that these actors in particular, but actors working in professional theater in general, usually have pretty good training. And when we're dealing with issues like that, like a line doesn't quite sound right or doesn't work for that character, they always do so respectfully. And honestly, it's something that if it's not working, I hear it pretty quickly. And I'll say, you know, Mark, Jacoby, how is this line working for you? You know, and we'll talk it through. So that's absolutely part of the process. But it's also true that, you know, they aren't writing the play. I am writing the play. And I think that everyone in the room understands that.
So there is that definition of role.
That's right. That's true. Just like the director has his role, I don't, you know, start staging the play with him there. Likewise, people don't try to write the play for me. I think that our training in American theater really teaches everyone those roles pretty well these days.
Right, but there's still that, it sounds like that, at least in this process here, that there's room for the collaboration and the kind of saying, you know, not that I'm trying to write it for you, but this feels awkward, or gosh, wouldn't it be more interesting if we did this? And then you're free to reject it or say sure.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Sure.
So Mark, you know, I know you've started this new play development here. What are some of the challenges in getting people to actually come see it? I mean, do you find that audiences here are receptive to the idea of seeing something they've never seen before?
I wish I had a definitive answer for you, you know, because, for example, one of the very first new plays we produced under this particular arrangement was Rick Cleveland's Five Presidents, and that was turned out to be the fifth best-selling play of all time at Milwaukee Rep. Did huge business, broke records at Arizona Theater Company, where we co-produced it, and then did the same up in Sag Harbor at Bay Street Theater in the Hamptons. And, you know, that was a new play, but it was a title, and it was very clear what the blurb was about. So I think American Song was a more challenging thing. It was another new piece that we did about guns and the challenges of bringing teenagers and when what we do as parents and getting in and out of the way, and that in fact actually there are no rules at all and we just have to use our instincts, and sometimes we get it right and sometimes we get it wrong. That was a much more challenging play to sell than Five Presidents, because it was very clear and obvious what it was, and the idea of seeing, you know, five living presidents at the time in the room at Nixon's funeral was just kind of, I have to see that, you know. And I think the only thing that I answer really I have about that is I think you have to be in it for the long term. I think if you just slot down a new play and expect everyone to turn up because it's new and exciting, it's just not going to work. You know, so you're cultivating a habit. And it's interesting, you know, now we do, when I came here, nobody had ever done a musical on the main stage for 60 years or whatever it was. Then we did them and they were successful, and now they are core part. We started Rep Lab in my first year, and we couldn't barely sell tickets, and nobody knew what it was and was confused. And now that sells out before we do it 8, 9 years on, before we even open. And there, I think that's the part of it, is that be have a plan, stick to it, let it roll out, be prepared to fail, do some, you know, clunkers. Ed Actor, you know, said that when we did a new play development event at the gala a couple of years ago. It's like, you know, and I term it that you have to kiss a lot of frogs sometimes to get the prince. And it's not an exact process. And it's like going to see movies. You know, it's interesting that we go to see movies that actually we don't want to know anything about. But the theatre, there's a sort of the reverse, because there's a familiarity, you know, whether that's to do with cost, because a theatre ticket is probably exponentially larger than a cost of a movie ticket. I don't know. You know, I'm not sure what the psychology of that is. But I think we're just in it for the long game and just say, hey, once a season on the main stage, we're going to do a new play or a premiere, or an American premiere, or an English translation of a play that was, you know, had been had had great success in Europe, and that's what we were going to do, you know, and stick with that and see how people go on the journey. It's true when we started, even though Ayad Akta is from Milwaukee, when we first did the play, his first play, Invisible Hand, you know, people were, oh, well, that sounds interesting. Now, as we do, you know, we've just done the third one, everybody knows what that is, and they're on a journey with the writer. So we cultivate an audience with the other writers, with Catherine, with Joanna Murray Smith, with Dale Orlando Smith, and the writers that we're interested in working with. And so the audience start to get to know writers like they get to know actors and have their favorites.
And I imagine as a writer, that's really kind of nice to know that you've got a following, that people are like interested in seeing what you're coming up with next.
Yeah, absolutely. You're always looking for your artistic homes, you know, places that you can revisit both the audience and your collaborators.
And so are you planning to do more once this one comes up?
I certainly hope so.
So this is one of the ones we're cultivating, Mark?
Oh, yes, for Catherine. Sure, yeah. In fact, Catherine told me a story. She writes a blog, and she told me a story that I said, there's your next play, I think. And she said, oh, okay. I told her last night, actually, we had some dinner, and I said, if you want to write that play, I'll commission you for it.
Don't tell me now. We'll talk about it once you get it written.
Okay, that's
all right.
Good.
Is that a promise?
That's
all
a
right.
Promise.
I want to thank you both so much for taking time.
Thanks,
thank
Bonnie.
You.
Catherine Trishman is the playwright and Mark Clements, the director of the new play One House Over, which is playing now on the Milwaukee Rep's main stage. You'll find more information and pictures of the production at WUWM.com. I'm Mitch Teich, Bonnie North in the studio with us as well. This is day three of our winter member drive. We have a goal of 12 new or renewing members making their membership call or going online during this hour of Lake Effect. 414-227-3210 or WUWM.com/give. And Bonnie, the great thing about arts coverage on a show like Lake Effect is it's almost, I don't want to use the term ammunition, but it's great background because so many of our listeners listen to Lake Effect, but they also go to productions at the Milwaukee Rep, for example. And when you go to the production of One House Over, you have this interview in the back of your mind that gives you the understanding that really kind of brings the play to a new level.
One of the things I've always tried to do with arts coverage is to get people behind the scenes, whether it's behind the scenes literally at the theater or how a musician makes the music that they do or how an artist paints or throws the pot that they do. And it helps all of us understand our world better, and it helps us understand how artists create. And that's exactly the kind of thing you are supporting by calling 414-227-3210, by going to WUWM.com and making a contribution. You know, we talk about beat reporters here at WUWM. Well, the arts coverage was the first, very first one 12 years ago.
And you know, it's the kind of thing where we like to think whether we're doing arts coverage or any other kind of interview, we really try to be a proxy for you as a listener because we know you don't have a chance necessarily to meet the playwright behind the new play at the Milwaukee Rep or the author of that book who's going to be at Boswell or really many of the people that we have a chance to bring to the studio are it's our chance to introduce them to you. And it's our responsibility to ask them the kind of questions that hopefully are the ones that you would ask if you had a chance to meet them. Won't you take just a couple minutes now and support this unique resource that we have in Milwaukee? Lake Effect, whether it's Lake Effect or Fresh Air or the BBC World Service or Here and Now or any of the programs that are part of an important part of your life, 414-227-3210, WUWM.com/give. And when you make your contribution today only, between now and midnight, you're entered to win a drawing, one of five WUWM gift baskets plus a WUWM day sponsor message.
We'll take one more break and then new research that shows the efficacy of programs like Girls on the Run in changing lives. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
more of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. There are a lot of stressors on grade school students these days, especially young girls. Areas such as confidence, health, creating a positive body image. Well, Girls on the Run of Southeastern Wisconsin tries to help girls navigate these challenges through a 10-week program that includes group lessons for a 5K run.
Since 2007, Girls on the Run has helped more than 5,000 Milwaukee girls in grades 3 through 8 with a 10-week curriculum that goes beyond just the 5K. Leaders of the group point to 5 C's: competence, confidence, character, connection, and contribution. They say the goal is to instill habits that'll help girls far beyond their time in the program.
Now, Girls on the Run has data that shows it's working. Tina Jones, executive director of Milwaukee Girls on the Run, joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about why establishing confidence in young girls is so important.
You know, the girls are learning specific skills and strategies, such as how to manage their emotions, help others, make intentional decisions, and resolve conflict that they then use at home, they use at school, and they use with their friends. And the 5 C's that we call it, the competence, confidence, caring, character, connection, and contribution, we address all of these in this 10-week curriculum that does such an amazing job of, first, we address the girl herself, because you're not going to be able to reach out to others and help others until you really understand who you are and what you're made of and what you can do. And so what comes with that is learning about confidence and learning about uniqueness and who you are as an individual. And so the first part of the program addresses that. And so we talk to the girls about what makes you unique. We teach the girls about what makes others unique. And these discussions are helping these girls really grow and learn to appreciate these differences. And then what we do in the next part of the 10-week curriculum, we're really addressing, how do you fit in with your teammates? So we address topics that are looking at how you work well with others and how you're connected. And that connection may not have happened in the typical school day. It's when these girls have this safe environment with Girls on the Run that they're able to really flourish and connect with others. And that's the second part of the 10-week program. And then we move into the final part of our 10-week curriculum, which is really at looking at how the girls fit in the community at large. And we talk about how important it is to be a good person in your community and to contribute. And that's not only your school community, but that's your community outside of school.
You touched upon that Girls on the Run is an environment for girls to flourish. What is contrary in society or perhaps in their everyday lives in school or at home that diminishes the growth of these skills in young girls?
A lot of what is pushed out to these girls via social media or the media in general of how these girls need to look just right, they need to act just right. A lot of these messages that are being pushed out to these girls, the girls are taking in, and it is found that they have lower self-esteem at these young ages. They have lower self-confidence because they think they need to look like the people that are out there. And we have a lot of discussions in our Girls on the Run lessons about self-image and self-esteem. And I feel that these discussions are just so necessary and important because the girls need to understand that it is all about what is inside. And once you learn to love yourself, your outside is as beautiful as anyone else that you see out there. That's the messages that are pushed out. And that's what's going to help them flourish.
One new thing you guys did this year was a longitudinal study, and this kind of quantitates the things, the conversations you're having with these girls in the small groups. So can you explain to me why you decided to go about this and what the focus was?
So we knew this program was working, but we really wanted to get those numbers to prove that it in fact was. And we had a leading researcher, Dr. Maureen Weiss, come out and do this longitudinal study that looked over 3 years at the results of how our program was working. And what the longitudinal study showed is that the Girls on the Run program is effective in driving transformative change in the lives of young girls. And from this study, we learned that 97% of our girls learned critical life skills that they use at home, in school, and with friends. 85% improved in the five C's that we were talking about. So they improved in their confidence. They improved in their competence, caring, character, and connecting to others. And then 85% are better able to manage their emotions. 80% are able to resolve conflicts. And 90% said that what they learned allows them to help others. And then when it comes to improving activity, the girls in our program who were least active, so the girls we want to help the most, they improved their activity by more than 40%. And they maintained this increased level beyond the season's end. And we just know, I know there's a lot of, these are a lot of numbers that I'm throwing out, but these are really impressive numbers that is showing that these girls, their self-esteem, their self-confidence, their physical activity is all increasing because of this Girls on the Run program.
I want to go into a couple areas that you mentioned. So one of the critical life skills with emotion management and conflict resolution, I think this is key in helping these girls, you know, get ready for those teenagers, for high school, you know, better relationships with their peers and with their parents. So what are some examples of how these girls learn to manage their emotions or to help work them through a conflict that they may be having either at home or at school?
Yeah, great question. I mean, with the management of the emotions, there's a number of different lessons that we talk about in Girls on the Run. One of them is to stop, breathe, and listen. And we hear all the time that the girls are using that. They are really taking the time. If there's an emotionally charged discussion that they're having with another girl, with a parent, with a sibling, with a teacher, they're taking the time to really stop, to take some deep breaths and think about the situation before they go ahead and respond. And, you know, as an adult, I mean, we hear this all the time. Many adults use it. Many adults don't
use this.
And so it really, that's a super important lesson that I get feedback all the time that it's really working. And they're seeing it in the homes. They're seeing it in the schools. And they're using it at practice. So that's one way of managing the emotions. Another thing is these girls are learning how this physical activity makes them feel better. It evens out their emotions. They're having a really stressful day, and they go to the Girls on the Run practice, and they're getting their energy out, and any maybe some negative emotions, positive emotions, anything, they're able to work those out just by physical activity alone. And that's a huge, huge lesson in itself. And I see that with myself. I'm a runner myself. I know that if I can get my run or my walk in during the day, I have a better day. And these girls are learning that too.
Definitely. I use exercise as stress relief all the time, for sure, to end the day especially. You mentioned 90% of girls use what they use in this program to help others. And for some reason, that really stood out to me on the page. Why is this critical, do you think? And does this say something about the curriculum or the girls themselves in particular?
You know, there's a lot of innate pieces to it where we girls are raised and have a nurturing component in them, for sure. But a lot of it as well is curriculum driven here. And we are teaching these girls about really being kind to others. And they're finding that what happens is when they're kind, they're getting these great responses back that then helps make them feel good. So they're giving, but they're getting back so much more by that giving.
That especially is important as they go into their high school years, especially, or even older adult life.
Absolutely. I mean, the program is really setting the groundwork to help these girls deal with the bigger issues that come along with the older teenage high school years. And then, of course, into adulthood. We all know that we've got so many of the same issues that these young kids deal with, we deal with as adults.
With trend reports, why was it important for Girls on the Run to take this step? Earlier, you mentioned this is the first time you've done this. This has about 3 years of data. So how does it help all people involved in the programs outside of learning what the girls are getting out of this? You know, the teachers, the coaches, everyone.
So we're really excited to start getting some more information on trending. And we've just started to get this information fed down to us from our national Girls on the Run organization because we understand that people want to hear really concrete reasons how this program is helping us today and deal with the issues that we are all dealing with today and these kids are dealing with. And so the trend reports are starting to come in, and some of the areas that we all know that is affecting us day in and day out are things like technology. One of the recent trend reports that has come in is really focusing on how teenagers are being reported to be online almost constantly. And teenagers ages 13 to 17 are not only reported being online almost constantly, but 73% have a smartphone or access to one. And so how does that affect these children? And then how can Girls on the Run help?
Right.
And that's really what we're learning from these trend reports and trying to address these issues with our coaches, with our parents, and with the girls, and bring those real concrete lessons to them. And so, for example, some of the trends with technology is they are finding that technology is not creating new issues for teens. And I thought this was super interesting. But it's merely exacerbating developmentally normal concerns, social standing, identity development, and self-expression. And the effects are profound and can include things like increased anxiety, isolation, abuse, social exclusion, and decrease in self-esteem and social emotional competence. Now, these are all really key areas that as parents, we're super interested in hearing how do we keep our kids from going down that sliding scale. And so what we are doing with Girls on the Run to help address some of the issues that's happening with technology is, first of all, we are a technology-free zone. And so it's a safe environment that we offer at our Girls on the Run practices. And the girls are learning about things that are put out there in the social media and the media itself that may have a negative impact on them. And so we're discussing that. It's face-to-face, and we have real discussions on it.
And a lot of this, both in the trend reports and the longitudinal study that you guys have conducted, is a way of reflecting not only on progress that the organization has made, progress in numbers, progress in even closing the time distance on how long it takes a girl to work up to a 5K. But when you get feedback from the girls themselves, one quote included in the response was that Girls on the Run makes me powerful. And I thought that was a particularly good quote to highlight. So with surveying the girls' response, is this voluntary? Is it mandatory? And do you find that they're more open to sharing how it impacted them because of the environment of face-to-face, of the importance of communication, of feedback?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way the longitudinal study was conducted was face-to-face, and it was mandatory. So they conducted the surveys during practices, and then they also had surveys that they did after the program happened, but it was always during school and during a set time. And so it was mandatory. But what is great is these girls, they had already built up trust in the coaches and they had learned the lessons in the program. And, you know, there was that trust where they felt that safe environment to answer what we would hope are, you know, the answers that are what their true feelings are. And so the longitudinal studies have really given us some just amazing information on how these girls are really feeling about the program and what actions are being taken, what they're doing differently physically and mentally because of the program.
Well, Tina Jones, thanks for coming in and sharing some of this information with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Tina Jones is executive director of Milwaukee's Girls on the Run, and she spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. The organization hosts its annual sneaker soiree tomorrow at the Italian Community Center. You can learn more about the organization's recent reports at WUWM.com. WUWM.com/give is the place to turn to take an active role in supporting programs like Lake Effect. In fact, take an important role in supporting Lake Effect and the other programs you hear, whether it's Morning Edition or All Things Considered or Fresh Air, any of the programs. They're all on the air directly as a result of your support. This is day 3 of the Winter Member Drive, and you can help make it a success. Help us reach our goal of 12 new or renewing members this hour by calling 414-227-3210 or visiting WUWM.com.
And today only, when you do that, you will be entered into a drawing to win one of 5 WUWM gift baskets, including a WUWM Day sponsor message. Now, donations aren't required, but they are surely appreciated. And of course, as we've said, that is what makes all the programming possible. We are so close to getting our 12 new or renewing members. Won't you be the one to make us hit our goal? 414-227-3210, WUWM.com.
And, you know, I'm looking at this gift basket. I don't know if everything that's in this gift basket is in every one of the 5 we're giving away, but if that's the case, there's some really cool stuff in there, ranging from socks to an NPR or a public radio nerd shirt to a water bottle to what looks like another water bottle. It's really cool, and it is a great way to rock the public radio love. That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for rocking the public radio love with us today. I do hope you'll be with us again tomorrow as well for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next.